This is Scenic Roots Talking Writing. My guest is Devereux Chivington Stebbins, whose pen name is C.S. Devereux. She writes historical novels, memoirs, and short stories. This past spring, her short story Old Gem placed second in the fiction category in the Chattanooga Writers Guild Spring Writing Contest. Another short story, Beyond the Breakers, placed first in the creative non-fiction category. This is Devereux reading an excerpt from Old Gem.
Old Gem. Heat waves shimmered off the sidewalk and hung in the air like a dank cloak in our quiet section of Jacksonville, Florida, that summer of 1953. Our apartment was a repository of stifling stickiness that threatened to leech the very life from us. With my father mostly absent, my mother, who was pregnant with my baby brother, was anxious for the relief of childbirth. Her belly grew larger daily. Bad-tempered and edgy, each day after breakfast she put me out the front door into the lobby of our apartment building, leaving me to my own devices. I was 5. The entry hall was cool with its alabaster floors and tiled walls. A marble staircase led to the second floor, and behind the stairs a water fountain hung on the wall. "Never drink from this fountain," Mama said. "The water will make you sick." It's the janitor's water fountain, and not meant for whites. There were no kids to play with, so I created an imaginary friend, Doc. I trusted Doc because he was always right. And there was Zoot, a stuffed purple donkey, my baby word for the color of his fuzzy coat, purple. Zoot was so very purple that I thought of him that way long after I learned to say the word properly. The two of them accompanied me everywhere. One day, after playing for hours on the lobby steps, I was thirsty and wanted a cool drink. An old wooden chair stood in a dark corner near the fountain. I moved it closer and was climbing onto it when it tipped over. I fell hard to the floor and banged my knees and elbows. I squeezed my lips together so as not to cry. The sound would alert Mama, and I would be in trouble. "Hold on there, little gal. I'll help you." A black man set me on my feet and assisted me in getting a drink. The water had a slightly salty metallic flavor, like the tap water in my apartment, like all Florida water that I had tasted. "Thank you. My name is Vita Lynn Haney. What's yours?" "Nice to meet you. I'm Hezekiah, Hezekiah Red. The boss man, Mr. Park, he called me Old Jim after his dog. So when I'm working here, best you call me Old Jim." "Why do you do that?" "Well, Miss Vita Lynn, seem like that dog is a hard-working good old hunting dog. If and he named me after his dog," Mr. Park said, "then maybe I'd be a good hard worker too." I had seen him sweeping, mopping, and doing odd jobs around the building, but we had never spoken, and I was keen with curiosity. "You don't look old. Where's your white hair?" "You're right. I ain't so old." "Looky there. Your knees ain't hardly colored up no more." I squinted up at him. I could see why Mr. Park called him Jim. Hezekiah Red was a mouthful. "If it's all right, I'll call you Old Jim, too, until I get a little bigger. You won't tell Mama about getting me a drink from your water fountain, will you?" "No, ma'am. Your secret is safe with me."
Our guest, Devereux Chivington Stebbins, reading from her short story, Old Gem. Before we started talking about the story, I asked Devereux about a quote on her website. It's from a writer called Jacob Norby, who wrote, "Blessed are the weird people, poets, misfits, writers, mystics, painters, troubadours, but they teach us to see the world through different eyes." And do you think you're weird?
Am I weird? No, I think I am controlling and a perfectionist and absolutely impossible sometimes to deal with.
I think anybody who creates something from nothing is probably going to be controlling at times because it's so close. Difficult because it's difficult work. And it's hard to take criticism. And it's hard sometimes to share the world with other people when you're in the midst of doing something like that?
Well, that's true. It's also hard to separate yourself from something you've created. Everything that I write, there's something of me in all of it. These short stories in particular happen to be about me, but typically I don't write about myself at all. I'm not comfortable writing about myself. These were a real stretch for me. I wrote them during the lockdown. It was a real introspective period for me, so I thought I'd take advantage of it. These are some things that came out of it. The writing contest just happened to coincide with the new things I was putting out. I thought, well, let's give it a shot and just brace yourself and see what happens.
The story about the black man, Old Jim, I kept thinking, I wonder if this is Devereux, this little girl. It's a work of fiction, you said.
It is a work of fiction, but there's a lot of me in that. And I did live in Jacksonville, Florida, that point in my life. And I mean, a lot of it is true. But I took bits and pieces from that time period and put them together. What prompted it was, oh gosh, this year, last year, but this year especially, the violence and the police violence against Black people and the ongoing prejudice against Blacks that, of course, having grown up in the South, has been around my whole life. While we have made great strides in my lifetime, it hasn't been enough. I just remember when I was very small, always questioning, you know, why are there two water fountains? Why are there two restrooms? Why is there a separate entrance? Why do they have to sit behind, you know, in the back of the bus behind this sign? All these things. And my mother, she harbored a lot of those same feelings that other people, other white people did. And so she fed me what she believed to be truth. Often it was misinformation, but that's what she grew up with. My father and his family, on the other hand, were not that way. That was very confusing. I didn't have one story. I had conflicting accounts and conflicting reasons for things, and I decided I liked my father's frame of reference better because I saw people as all one, always did and always will. So it's something that's been really alive for me my whole life. So seeing it, how it has just really come to the forefront this past year in particular, just made me think about those times, and I wanted to just show that it's been around, this isn't new, and it should stop. It needs to stop now.
What was Jacksonville like when you were growing up then?
It was hot. I just remember it being hot. We moved to Birmingham not long after that. I was five still. It was right before my sixth birthday. The things that I describe, watching the ladies with their bundles of laundry on their head, with their parasols, their umbrellas to keep the heat off them, I remember things like that. I remember tamale trucks, tamale carts. And I remember that probably because the word was so funny. Mm-hmm. But I was very small. My world was very small, too, because I was alone for most of it. That wasn't an isolated incident. I was alone most of the time. Or I was with my parents. And I was also very young. So at my age, I remember clips of things, but there are parts that really stand out. This was one of them. So I can't tell you very much. Those were just my impressions.
Yeah, I get this sense of the feeling of a kind of small country town.
Well, it probably was then. Mm-hmm. Much smaller. There's the St. John's River. It runs through what may have been the middle of the city at that time, because I imagine that the city was built around it because of ports.
Part of, for me, what makes the story work is that intense parochialism. What people think or believe outside of this fairly narrowly prescribed culture is irrelevant. And whatever the authority figures within that culture want to do, they can do it. And with impunity.
Yes.
I thought you caught that really well. It's interesting where you left off reading it. It ends with, "It'll be our secret."
Yes.
Kind of pregnant with, really? So what happened then?
I didn't mean for it to be like that.
Well, that's what people believe. That's why that man, they didn't even ask him. The sense is that he has no counsel. He is resigned to a reality that is beyond his control, that is so completely unfair and cruel.
Yes, I know.
This man's going to end up in prison probably for the rest of his life.
No, he didn't. There was a janitor. I don't remember his name. We were friendly because he was the only person I had to talk to. Mm. And I did see him with his family when we moved to the new house. But I don't think I was on my way to go live with him. I was just mad at my mother.
Yeah, that's understandable.
I decided to take an adventure. But that little incident in the drugstore, it wasn't quite as dramatic as that, but he did come in. And he said, "What are you doing here? You know, have you been?" Because he hadn't seen me in a long time. The manager, that young guy, took the whole thing the wrong way because we knew each other, didn't ask any questions. It didn't matter when I tried to say, well, I was only 5 years old. So I probably didn't express myself very well either. But he called the police. I guess he must have gotten hold of my father at some point because he arrived soon after. They took him away. And my father took me home. I had a chance to calm down and explain what happened. My mother was able to, you know, she could verify, oh, yeah, there was this guy, the janitor that Devereaux was friendly with. Was that the same one? He said, yes. My father called and went down to the station, and he explained the whole thing, and they let him go. But had that not happened, yes, he probably would have gone to prison for the rest of his life for just being kind to a little girl.
Yeah, but in the real world, you're not Shirley Temple, he's not Mr. Bojangles, and
exactly.
You know, he's a black man, and you're a little girl with blonde hair.
Yeah, that's right.
In the South in the 1950s, and that reality comes home, that reality of where you are comes home when you introduce yourself to him, and he introduces himself to you, and then says, but the boss man calls me Old Jim.
Exactly. After his dog, yeah.
And you say, oh my God, you capture a world in a sentence.
Right. Well, are the little things like that are what make it fiction, but it was reality. The story is fiction because the janitor in my building probably was not named after the owner's dog.
<Let's>
But that's the sort of thing that could happen. That's the sort of thing that did happen back then. The black help, if you will. They were called whatever the employer wanted to call them, and they just had to accept it.
That's the art of what you do. The alchemy of what you do, that you take a real world and a real world situation and you tell a story within that world that makes the world more real than it would be if you were to just recount facts.
Exactly. That's what writers do.
And you do it really well.
Oh, thank you.
This is Scenic Roots talking writing. My guest is Devereaux Chivington Stebbins, whose short story, Beyond the Breakers, won first place in the creative nonfiction category in the Chattanooga Writers Guild's Spring Writing Contest. This is Devereaux reading an excerpt from Beyond the Breakers.
Beyond the Breakers is a coming-of-age story about a summer in my life when I was around 11 years old. It is set in Neptune Beach, Florida, the summer of 1961 at my grandparents' home. On the day I'm writing about, it had stormed all day. It is now late afternoon. Our grandfather, Big Dean, grudgingly agrees to take us out to the beach. Sand stings my legs and the wind tugs at my rubber tire tube as we make our way down the boardwalk steps. The beach is empty. Even the ever-present surfers have declined the ocean's invitation. Waves rush at us in crashing arcs. They pound the sand in angry protest at our invasion of their domain. Reconsidering the wisdom of venturing into the water, I suggest we browse for shells and other treasure the storm washed up. The ocean is too rough, and look, the shallows are full of dirty foam and seaweed. I don't want to get in that. Big Dean shouts a reply. Whipping wind steals his words the instant they leave his mouth. He places himself between me, the wind, and the bellowing surf. To know the ocean is to know life, Margaret. One of the sea's lessons is here in front of you. Sometimes you must wade through the muck to reach the good place beyond the breakers. Follow me. Reluctantly, my siblings and I tuck our towels and bag of sunscreen, pail and shovel under the boardwalk steps, and clutching our inflatable lifesavers, wade behind him into the cold, storm-wrought sea. We do our best to dodge the dingy mounds of foam. Long strands of seaweed envelop our legs. Random jellyfish stingers brush against us. They sting my calves, then my thighs, and finally my arms as I plunge into deeper water. I teach my little brother how to tackle rough breakers and duck under cresting waves. Next to us, Big Dean drags my sisters in their swim rings over the tops of waves. The salty spray catches them in the face. Turn away from the wave, I shout. Hang on tight to your rings. On the backside of thundering surf, the rolling sea is reasonably calm. Big Dean treads water between me and my siblings, the back of his head breaking the tops of passing swells. I bobble beside him, my rubber donut ring around my midsection where the fat lingers on my gangly frame. A strong undertow tugs at my dangling limbs. The boardwalk steps where we stashed our gear is a long way off and moving farther away by the minute. We should go back. Relax, we're fine, Big Dean replies. But the tide is still going out. If we aren't careful, the undertow will pull us out with it. I said, we're fine. Apprehensive, I gaze at the distant shore. Behind me, white water sizzle is accompanied by the crack of a breaker and a sudden slap to the back of my head. A rogue roller flips me upside down too fast for me to close my eyes. Submerged, the surface cacophony is muffled thunder above a ceaseless convolution, close yet far away. I spot my grandfather in the dreary haze. His baggy swimsuit drifts with the ebb and flow of the tide between pasty belly and skinny legs. Next to him, my heedless brother and sisters kick the briny water from the underside of their tubes, legs pumping in slow motion. Strands of seaweed churn about. Tiny grains of sand and particulate float around us in an aimless dance. Seashells and bits of debris, half buried in the ocean floor below, are barely discernible in the moody light. I wriggle and twist to extricate myself from my rubber ring, feeling like a fish caught on a hook. My legs kick empty air topside. My arms flail underwater. The tube refuses to budge from my chubby body. My lungs ache. I flounder, becoming more frightened by the second. Then I see it. In the not-too-distant murkiness, a large, dark fish shape hovers near the surface. It eyeballs us. We are worthy of inspection, and with a swish of its tail, it glides closer.
The second story is about a young girl, and there's something apparently of Devereaux again, but you're older now. You're on the cusp between being a child and being a teenager, which is such a difficult time in your life to essay, isn't it?
It is, and that one is nonfiction because that whole incident was exactly what happened. It took me a long time to write it because very difficult for me to express that point in my life when I let go of childhood. And that singular event, those things that happened on that day, catapulted me into the next stage of life. It was the first time that I had questioned adult authority, and it was the first time I made a judgment call that could have had catastrophic results. As it happened, I did the right thing, and that in itself was significant. And my parents accepted that. Thank God you got all of you out of the water, and he should never have taken you in there on a stormy day like that and out so far with the undertow and, you know, all the things that happened, and you could have drowned and, you know, on and on and on. It was quite an emotional story. I blocked it for a long time, and I started digging it out, and it came little by little. I think I've been working on that for several years before I finally got it all together this spring. One reason that I wanted to write it was because I think it's a story that others can relate to. And if it helps one person to understand themselves better, or it helps a parent to understand their tween a little better and what young teens go through when they've reached a point in their life when so much is happening, besides just the hormone rush, but they begin to mature a little bit and see the world a little bit differently and question authority. Are my parents making the right decision? Usually kids aren't mature enough to make good decisions all the time themselves, but they're at a point where they begin to question that if they haven't already. And that makes it very difficult for both the kids and the parents. Of course, we all know. Anyway, I wanted to put it out there because if it helps one person in some way, then it's worth the effort.
I thought it was interesting, the juxtaposition of those two stories. There's this feeling, first of all, that adults aren't entirely trustworthy.
They aren't.
and a little hostile at times. But that was, you know, you explained that. Your mum's pregnant. It's hot. You know, all of those things that to another adult, they would say, what do you expect? But to a kid.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
To a child, your expectation is equally reasonable that your mum should be somebody you can always go to. She's never mean. She never hits you. She listens to what you have to say. But beyond that is that sense that guy behind the counter in the drugstore in Old Jim, he doesn't recognize you as having any autonomy at all. He picks you up, he puts you on the counter that's too high. Mm-hmm. He jumps to conclusions and doesn't listen to anything you have to say.
Exactly, yeah.
And the same could be said of your grandfather.
That's right. So, anyway, yeah.
Well, I'm just wondering, you know, was that conscious on your part? Was that something that, as you were coming of age, you found, I mean, we all found, I assume everybody does anyway, found the adult well, frequently mystifying. You know, a lot of the time it's really difficult to understand why people do the things they do and say the things they do and affect the attitudes that they have. There's a sense in both those children of a profound sense of independence and of clarity in their perspective of things. I see things pretty clearly. It's you that's having the trouble.
Right. Well, don't kids think that they see things very clearly?
Well, they do, don't they?
They don't necessarily. They can't necessarily more clearly than we give them credit.
Yeah, they can't explain it, but they're going to give you an unvarnished take on it. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be like adults who feel they have to explain it. They couldn't if they wanted to.
Right. That's all part of what this is about. The kids' point of view, the mystery of adults not understanding why they are the way they are, because as a small child, you don't understand it, so you don't question it. You just don't like it, you know, sometimes. You don't understand it, you know.
Right.
It makes life difficult on occasion.
Well, you came of age in such a fraught time, especially to be in the South.
Yeah.
You lived through all of the civil rights struggles of the 50s and 60s, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, I did.
And from what you just said, you know, to some degree, within your own household.
Yeah. Yeah. When I think about it now, I'm actually glad that I grew up then, because it gave me such a perspective on the world that fits right in with what's going on now. It makes things a lot more clear, doesn't make them right. It makes me very angry that it's still, you know, still happening, but I don't know. I'm just kind of glad that I did grow up then with all of that, the unrest that was happening then. It was terrible, and I hated it then. Sometimes I wished I had been born sooner or maybe later, but just not then. It seemed like such a terrible time to be alive.
Well, I can only imagine. I can only imagine.
Yeah.
You have all that tumult inside you because you're a teenager, mm-hmm. and you're surrounded with chaos. You know, you said, blessed are the weird people. An environment like that, man, it was just too easy to feel weird. What do you do with that when you're a teenager? You know, you don't want to be weird. You want to be like everybody else, you know?
Well, I felt weird too, because I wasn't like everybody else.
No.
That was all I wanted was to be accepted into a group and to be like everyone else. I wanted to wear the clothes that had to have just that label on it and be from this store and be just like this and my hair like this and do everything that everyone else does. And I didn't do any of that. I wasn't allowed to conform to that extent. And so what I did was I went the other extreme. Well, if I can't do this, then I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do it well and just be a total outcast.
And look where you ended up. You ended up as a writer, and what better place to see the world, what better perspective, you know, than to be seeing everything from the outside. See it so clearly.
That's right.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
You've had an interesting life, judging from your bio. Lived in several big cities.
Yeah, and I set out to have an interesting life. I didn't want to do mom and apple pie and have the little cottage with the white picket fence and all of that. I wanted to see the world. You touched on one of the things we were going to discuss, was why I write. Mm. And that goes way back. When I was 8 years old, one of my teachers asked me, well, an assignment was to write a composition. It was my first composition, and I got an F. When my father saw not just the grade, but what I had written, I thought I was going to be in for it. But instead, he said, this is fantastic. And for the first time ever, I think he, you know, supported me and went down to the school and yelled at the teacher and said, this is imaginative, this is creative, and do you realize she's only 8 years old? And she wrote this. It really gave her a piece of his mind, and she changed my grade to a C minus.
That's big of a...
Yeah, I know, C minus, but at least it wasn't failing. But she actually wound up changing my life. I don't know what direction I would have gone if she hadn't done this. But in order to help me make up credit so I didn't get such a low grade, she had a small little library in a corner of her classroom. And she said, for extra credit, every time that there is free class time, you read. You can choose anything you want to read, but you must read. And so I chose books from a collection of biographies that she had. I didn't even know it was called a biography at that time, but, you know, they were written for young people about famous people, Martha Washington, Abigail Adams, Booker T. Washington. I read probably most of those books that year. I loved biographies, and I kept reading them and became so interested in other people's lives that I wanted to write one day about other people. Didn't want to write about myself, and I still don't really enjoy it that much, as I said before. I'd rather write about others. So that's why I write historical fiction and I write memoirs now. And I don't necessarily want to write about famous people. I like writing about average people who've had who've had unaverage lives. But when I first started trying to write, I discovered that I didn't know anything about people. And I'd never been anywhere or done anything. So I realized that I needed to know more of the world if I wanted to write in the way that I liked writing. For many years, every time I sat down to write, it seemed like the only thing I could do was write a nice description of something. It just seemed like I wasn't ready yet. And then several years ago, maybe 10 years ago, maybe more, I don't know, I picked up Pillars of the Earth by Ken Follett. It blew me away. I love his books. Realized then that I had read others and didn't really even pay attention to the author. I had read Eye of the Needle and quite a few of his books. I didn't know I was already such a fan. But when I read Pillars of the Earth, I said something just clicked in me, and I said, you know what? I think it's time you started writing for yourself. You've developed a love of history. You have been all over the world at this point, and you know an awful lot. And you have a lot that you can put into a story and a lot of perspective. And I think that at that time, I said, now is the time. It's now or never. And that's when I began to write.
Devereaux Chivington Stebbins writes under the pen name C.S. Devereaux. Her most recent novel, Sky People, is set in the Smoky Mountains in the 19th century. It's a mostly true story of a Cherokee Indian family struggling through a time of widespread instability and social change. It's set for publication in the spring. Several of her short stories are on her website, csdevereaux.com. This is Scenic Roots, talking writing on listener-supported public radio in Chattanooga.